So this is the third lecture in this series of lectures on Tolkien, and this is about Tolkien and medieval literature. You know that he taught medieval literature in Oxford, but his interest in medieval literature and languages started in childhood. Already as a student at King Edward School in Birmingham, he was studying Gothic, Old English and Old Norse, all on his own initiative. This interest continued when he became a student in Oxford. And as a university lecturer, he became an author of important scholarly works on medieval literature. His editions of medieval texts, such as Old English Exodus and Middle English Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, are still used in university courses today. As you already know from Dr. Lee's lectures, Tolkien also did much to promote the study of medieval literature. When he was a lecturer at Leeds, he and his colleague Eric Gordon helped to organize a Viking club for the undergraduates, which met informally to read Old Norse sagas and drink beer. Later at Oxford, Tolkien founded the Coalbiters. Coalbiters was a group of scholars who met to read Icelandic sagas in the original. The word itself is based on Old Norse word, which literally means coal eater. It is a nickname similar to Cinderella. In Old Norse, it means good for nothing, an idle person who sits by the fire in winter. The study of ancient languages as part of an English language and literature degree was controversial already at Tolkien's time, and as recent events demonstrated, it is still controversial today. But it is all about passion, always was. Medieval literature was Tolkien's professional occupation throughout his career, but it also influenced him as a writer. He adopted elements of stories, plots, and even personal names. The story about a hero who kills a dragon using a weak spot found in The Children of Húrin and The Hobbit is known from an Old Norse poem, The Lay of Fafnir. This describes how the hero Sigurd killed the dragon Fafnir by hiding in a pit and stabbing Fafnir when he was crawling over the pit. Mirkwood, which Bilbo and the dwarves have to cross in The Hobbit, is a mythological forest in Scandinavian tradition, which separated the realms of the gods from their enemies, the giants. Many features of Bilbo's adventures in The Hobbit are based on Beowulf, such is his title Thief, the episode with the stolen cup, the path under the mountain leading to the dragon's lair, as well as Smaug's personality, his rage and the destruction of a nearby town. The influence of medieval literature on Tolkien is a very large field, and I will have to be very selective in my discussion today. But I would like to say something about two aspects of this influence: how medieval literature influenced Tolkien's narrative technique, and how it influenced his mythology and ideas. I will start with the narrative technique, and in particular, how Tolkien used place and personal names in his novels. There are some interesting parallels here with Old Norse sagas and also Old English and Old Norse poetry. You may have read some Icelandic sagas. They are prose narratives which survive in manuscripts from the 13th century and later, which tell about events from Icelandic, Norwegian, and Danish history. Old Norse word saga is derived from the Old Norse verb to say, so it could mean any narrative in prose. So there are sagas which tell about Norwegian and Danish kings, and there are sagas about the lives and deeds of bishops and Christian saints. But particularly famous are the so-called family sagas, which are stories about Icelanders who lived in the 10th and 11th centuries. The well-known Njáls saga is one of these. In family sagas, when a location is described, the names of farms, rivers, hills, and other geographical features are given with great accuracy. Sagas are full of place names, which tend to be real rather than invented. Editions and translations of sagas are often accompanied by commentary explaining the place names and the location of various natural features. Such editions often have maps of the areas where the events took place. This is from this Everyman edition of Everyman translation of three Icelandic outlaw sagas. Sagas are also have a large number of personal names, including the names of characters who play only a very minor role in the story, or are mentioned simply because they are somebody's relatives or ancestors. The names tend to be so abundant that to help the reader to cope with this feature, editions and translations of sagas are often accompanied by genealogical tables, and this one again from the same translation. And often glossaries of the personal names. This is the beginning of a combined glossary of personal names in this translation. Anything like this is rarely necessary in a modern novel, but we have all seen something like this in the editions of Tolkien's works. This is one of several genealogies which accompany the Children of Húrin, Tolkien's latest posthumously published work. And this is the first page from a list of names which accompanies the Children of Húrin. As you know, it is a relatively small book, but the list takes 19 pages. Tom Shippey in The Road to Middle-earth noted Tolkien's extensive use of place and personal names, particularly in The Lord of the Rings. He pointed out that whereas The Hobbit has some 40 or 50 personal names, The Lord of the Rings has over 600 names of persons, beasts, and monsters, almost as many places, with a couple of hundred unclassifiable but named objects. Shippey also observed that the rather simple maps included in The Hobbit gave way to the fold-out map of Middle-earth in the first edition of The Fellowship of the Ring, and several elaborate maps in other books, all of them full of details never directly used in the plot. The abundance of names in both Tolkien and Old Norse sagas is a striking feature, particularly because the names are present even if they contribute little to the main plot. They seem to have a value of their own, not limited to their usefulness for telling the story, creating identity for characters and places, or making the narrative look realistic. All these goals are achieved in most modern novels through the use of much fewer place and personal names. Such role of names in sagas seems to reflect their borderline position between fiction, which involves conscious invention and the use of names as a literary device, and a historical narrative. Tolkien's use of names deliberately breaks with the conventions of modern fiction and contributes to an impression that what one is reading is historical, real, or archaic. It is worth mentioning in this connection that not only historical narratives like sagas, but also medieval poetry sometimes includes the lengthy lists of names, which may constitute the main contents of a passage or even a whole poem. Such use of names in poetry rather than in a chronicle or a historical work surprises a modern reader. A good example of this is Old English poem Widsith. It is an anonymous work of uncertain date which survives in a 10th century manuscript known as the Exeter Book. Widsith means white journey in Old English. It is the name of the protagonist, who is a poet by trade, and tells about nations and kings who he knew or visited in his journeys. The poem consists of three lists of names connected by short lyrical and historical passages. At the beginning, Widsif is briefly introduced. Widsif spoke, unlocked the treasury of words. He who traveled most of all men through tribes and nations across the earth. We are then told that he began to speak at length. His speech begins with this line, "I have heard of many men who ruled over nations." This is followed by a list of these men and the nations they ruled over. What you can see here is only the beginning of this list in translation. It runs for about 25 lines. When it is over, Widsif says, "Thus I journeyed through many lands, throughout the spatial earth. Good and evil I experienced there, separated from my family. Distant from noble kinsmen, I served far and wide." So here we have a familiar topos of a lonely wanderer. The taxi driver motif, with which you may be familiar if you went to Dr. Lee's lectures on Old English literature. And this is very comforting for us, because we think we know what the poet is trying to say and how we are supposed to react. But this does not last long, because Widsith dives straight away into another lengthy list, this time of nations which he visited. And this goes on and on. And then at the end of the poem, there is a third list, this time of heroes and kings whom Widsif had known. Poetic lists like this are known by an Icelandic term, thulor. They probably had a mnemonic function, helping poets and audiences to remember the names and stories connected with them. But their role in Widsif and other poetry is unlikely to be purely utilitarian. The poem displays considerable skill, including a strict adherence to complex poetic meter, pride in poetic art, and seriousness of purpose, which suggests that it was written to be appreciated as poetry, and that the names themselves probably contributed to this effect. This is very difficult to understand, and most interpretations of Widsif by scholars depend on its easier to appreciate historical and elegiac passages, even though the lists of names form its main content and focus. Widsif has been interpreted as a begging poem, a poet advertising his skills and asking for patronage, as a poem about kingship, a poem about the power of poetry to grant fame and immortality, and as an educational text for a poet, a condensed compendium of heroic legends which formed part of his repertoire. However, scholars agree that none of these explanations are fully satisfactory. Widsif remains to be a headache for editors, commentators, and translators, and is rarely studied in university courses. It is not at all unique, however, because similar lists of names occur in other Old English and Old Norse poems. The one which is particularly relevant for Tolkien is the so-called Catalogue of Dwarves in an Old Norse poem, Völuspá, or Cirrus's Prophecy. It contains a story about the creation of the dwarves by the gods, followed by a list of their names, which occupies 8 stanzas. This is the beginning of the list, and as you can see, it contains various familiar names. Do you recognize this one? So we have Dwalin, and we have Dane here. And this one is looks familiar, doesn't it? And this one too. And here is Bomba and Nori. So you may know that this is the source for many of the dwarves in Tolkien's The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, including Thorin Oakenshield, Filey, Kiley, and others. Gandalf also occurs in this list as one of the dwarves, and his name translates Staff Elf. You may know that in the early drafts of the Hobbit, Gandalf is one of the dwarves. He is a chief dwarf. And then Tolkien changed this, but the staff remains one of his main attributes. This fascinating passage, the Catalogue of the Dwarves, found little favor with modern editors of the prophecy. Most believe it to be an interpolation, an edition made by a copyist, which could not have been part of the original poem because it is disproportionately long compared to the rest of the poem. Some editors omit the catalogue completely when printing the text of the prophecy. Ursula Dronke, the author of an important recent edition of the prophecy, provides the poem with an extensive commentary, but does not comment on the catalogue at all, dismissing it as an interpolation. However, similar lists of names are found in other Old Norse mythological poems, including, for example, Grimnir's sayings and the list of Rig. They also occur in early literature in other languages, and this is a famous example, a catalogue of ships which occurs in book 2 of Homer's Iliad and lists the contingents of the army that sailed to Troy. As you can see, it is a lengthy passage which runs for over 300 lines. This catalogue remains a major puzzle for Homeric scholarship. This is a quotation from a recent review of a book about this passage. And as you can see, according to Hendrik Müller, the catalogue of ships in the Iliad can count as one of the main fields of interest of Homeric scholarship since antiquity. Yet the question of its origin and intention is still controversial. Whatever the poet's goal and the response of the original audience, the fact remains that the lists of names were not uncommon in early poetry and was seen as entirely compatible with genuine poetic art, praised and displayed by the author of Widsith. Their purpose and reception remain a mystery, though, to use Tolkien's own words, this may be a mystery of names. In origin, all names were words of ordinary vocabulary, and their function was, as with any other words, to describe a person or an object. But as a result of their later developments, they became a highly specialized lexical group, isolated from ordinary vocabulary, and subject to different rules than other words. The modern use of names is largely conventional, and their original or etymological meaning is usually ignored. It seems, however, that before names have reached this modern state, they passed through a stage when they still retained some characteristics in common with ordinary words and preserved some of their original descriptive function. Thus, for example, unlike most modern names, many Anglo-Saxon names were made up of native elements, which also functioned as ordinary words in Old English. This can be seen here in names of the members of the Royal House of Wessex. As you can see, many of them included the element Ethel, which is Old English adjective meaning noble. the second part of the names can also be easily translated. In all these cases, this is an ordinary recognizable Old English word. So we have Æthelwulf here. The first part is Æthel, and the second part is wolf. We have Æthelstan. The second part is stone, presumably a precious stone, common part of Old English names. We have Æthelbald, and bald is bold or courageous. We have Æthelbert, and Bert is bright. And we have Æthelred, and red is what? Counsel or advice. Counsel or advice. It is the same word which survives in modern German. You know, when you go to a German, travel to a German city, what is called Rathaus, town hall. So it is the same words, Old English red, advice. What is particularly interesting is that the names did not come ready-made, but were coined from a stock of traditional elements such as Æthel, Bright, and others. So there was a creative effort involved. These elements were words connected with war, fame, beauty, power, and nobility, which were also part of the vocabulary of Old English heroic poetry. In addition, the names were coined using metrical devices, which were also found in poetry, such as alliteration and rhythm based on accent and syllable count. All this may help us to start understanding the reasons why names could constitute the content of poetry, recalling what was known about their owners, but also possibly creating an aesthetic impact. Tolkien imitated such conventions in his invented names and also wrote verse aimed to recall Old English and Old Norse Thulur. Many of his names are meaningful, such as Bairn, Old English word meaning man, warrior, or Theodon, Old English word meaning lord, king, or Grima Wormtongue. Grima is Old English word meaning mask, helmet, ghost. The word Bairn, by the way, is used only in poetry, and its original or etymological meaning is bear. And you can see this because it is etymologically related to various words in Germanic languages, meaning exactly this. But in Old English, it became restricted to poetry in this meaning as a metaphor for warrior and man. An ordinary Old English word meaning bear is bera, B-E-R-A. So as you can see, by the way, there is a good reason why in The Hobbit, Bairn changes into a bear. The idea that a name can tell us something about its owner, which recalls an archaic stage in the development of names as a lexical group, appears again and again in Tolkien's works. He was very interested in this. For example, Treebeard refuses to tell his real name to Merry and Pippin, explaining that real names tell the story of the things they belong to in his language. Tolkien's dwarves also never reveal their real or inner names to anyone of alien race, as Tolkien says in the appendixes to The Lord of the Rings. The names of some characters change, reflecting significant changes in their lives. When Gandalf returns to Middle-earth as Gandalf the White, he is first introduced by his elfish name Mithrandir, as you may remember. He then tells Gimli, "You may still call me Gandalf," but as Tolkien comments, he speaks of this name as something distant, a long disused word from an old memory. And similarly, Aragorn adopts a royal name Elisa when he becomes king. many conventions of a modern novel, including the use of names, reveal to the reader its nature as fiction, a deliberate invention. Tolkien's approach was often to avoid such conventions. The Lord of the Rings, for example, is full of references to events such as the story of Beren and Lúthien, or the story of the fall of Númenor, which are never fully explained within the book and are not directly relevant to the plot. Some are further explained in the appendixes, whereas others require the knowledge of Tolkien's published and unpublished works. But even when such references are not fully understood by the reader, they create a sense of reality, antiquity, and richness of the world of the Middle Earth. Tolkien believed that something like this happens in Beowulf, with its many historical digressions and references, and he wrote about this in his, or he spoke about this in his lecture, Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics. Tolkien used various other techniques which helped to mask the nature of his novels as 20th century fiction, including genealogies, the form of a chronicle as in the Silmarillion, and narrative frameworks which point to some external authority, such as the claim that the stories come from lost manuscripts in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. It appears that this confused some of Tolkien's readers. He wrote that his work was taken too seriously by several readers, and that several of his correspondents treated it as if it were a report of real times and places, which his ignorance or carelessness has misrepresented in places or failed to describe properly in others. Tolkien referred to this tendency as kind of a vast game. As a result of this, he had to argue about his own work, something similar to what he argued about Beowulf in The Monsters and the Critics, that this is fiction, a product of deliberate art and invention, and should be treated as such. His success in creating his own illusion of historical truth may be partly responsible for a persistent suspicion that he actually believed in legends and mythology which he invented. Medieval literature influenced not only Tolkien's narrative technique, but also many aspects of his mythology. The very word Middle Earth, as you may know, is an adaptation of Old Norse Midgard and Old English Midangerd, which means something like middle enclosure. Yerd is what develops into yard in modern English. The term enclosure suggests a limited civilized space separated from a wider, possibly hostile world around it. And indeed, Germanic creation myth, known from Scandinavian sources, tells about something like this. The creation of the Middle Earth is described in several poems of the Elder Edda. The Elder Edda is a collection of mythological and heroic poems surviving in several manuscripts from the 13th century and later. These poems tell about two races of gods, the Æsir, including Odin, Frigg, Thor, Bald, and others, and the Vanir, including Freyr, and others. The Seeress's Prophecy, a mythological poem which I have already mentioned, tells that Æsir created the sky and the earth at the beginning of the world. It also describes gods as the creation of civilization and culture. After the gods brought up the earth, they built altars and temples and made tools and precious things, as you can see. This is stanza 7 of the Seeress's Prophecy. The Aesir met on Idavol plain. They built altars and high temples. They set up their forges, smithed precious things, shaped tongs and made tools. The gods, however, were not alone in the world when the Middle Earth was created. There was another, more ancient race, the giants. The poems of the Elder Edda tell that gods created the world from the dismembered body of one of the giants, whom they presumably killed. So in Scandinavian mythology, the giants are the enemies of the civilized world created by the gods. The Seeress's prophecy tells that gods created two races to inhabit the Middle Earth, first the dwarves and then the humans. And as you know, in Tolkien's mythology, the dwarves are also the first race to be created. Interestingly, the dwarves seem to owe their existence to the gods' struggle with the giants. The Seeress's prophecy tells that gods enjoyed something like the Golden Age. They were happy after the Middle Earth was created, but this came to an abrupt end. This is the next stanza, stanza 8. They played checkers in the meadow. They were merry. They did not lack for gold at all, until three giant girls came, mighty and powerful, out of giant land. We do not know who the girls were, because this myth is not preserved in any other sources, but they seem to have caused some kind of disruption to the world created by the gods. Though, again, we're not sure what this disruption was. The gods' response was the creation of the dwarves. Though, again, the logic behind this action is unclear. And here is the next stanza of the Seeress's prophecy. Then all the powers went to the thrones of fate, the sacrosanct gods, and considered this. Who should form the lord of the dwarves out of Brimir's blood and from Blaine's limbs? We don't know who Brimir and Blaine are. They may be giants. There is an old English word, brim, which again appears only in poetry and which means sea, ocean. So he may be connected with the sea. Blaine means a dark one in Old Norse. But again, all this, our knowledge of this, of the creation myth, is fragmentary because it is preserved in some Old Norse poetry and prose, but there is much that we don't know. You can see the rest of this passage on your handouts and also the beginning of the catalogue of the dwarves. The gods seem to have passed to the dwarves some of their creative powers. Previously, the gods were the sole creators themselves, but from now on, the dwarves become the makers of precious things, which sometimes caused struggles and war. The dwarves also made important magical objects, which played a vital role in the survival of the worlds created by the gods, such as the magical ties which were used to tie the monstrous wolf Fenrir, an ally of the giants. The dwarves also made weapons for the gods and human heroes, including Odin's spear and Thor's hammer. So according to Lotte Motz, an author of important articles about the dwarves in Germanic mythology, they are depicted primarily as representatives of a profession, as craftsmen. Their role in the world hierarchy is that of serving spirits who support and sustain the cosmic order created by the gods. Tolkien was clearly inspired by this idea, by this image of Middle Earth inhabited by different races. Even though his elves, dwarves, and monsters are different from those of Scandinavian mythology. But he was also inspired by the idea that the history of the world unfolds as a struggle between hostile forces, such as the gods and the giants in Scandinavian mythology. And it is very obvious that in Tolkien's mythology, the history of the world also unfolds as a struggle, but there is a very important difference. Tolkien's world is a Christian one, because we should not forget that Tolkien pointed out on several occasions that The Lord of the Rings is a deeply Christian book. So in his world, the struggle is that between good and evil, and its outcome will be the victory of good. Ilúvatar, the god and the creator of the universe in Tolkien's mythology, is immortal and powerful, and the end of the world will be a triumph when evil will be defeated in the final battle. Tolkien writes about it or mentions this in several of his letters. But in Scandinavian mythology, the situation is very different. The eschatological myth describing the end of the world tells that there will be the final battle when the gods will fight against the giants and their allies. The end of the world is called Ragnarök, literally the doom of the gods. In the final battle, the main gods, including Odin and Thor, will be killed and the Middle Earth will perish. According to the seeress's prophecy, it will sink into the sea. There are other sources which describe a great fire at the end of the world. However, at some points, we are told that Middle Earth will rise again, and some of the younger gods, such as the sons of Odin and Thor, will survive and live peacefully again. According to one version of the seeress's prophecy, however, they will no longer rule the world. A stanza which occurs in one of the manuscripts of the Elder Edda tells about the arrival of a single powerful ruler who will replace the gods as the ruler of the earth, of the world. So perhaps an image inspired by Christianity. A very interesting feature of the myth about Ragnarök is that the gods will not be alone in the final battle. They will not be directly assisted by the dwarves, because in Scandinavian mythology, the dwarves do not fight. And this is a major difference between Tolkien's portrayal of the dwarves as they are portrayed in sagas and Eddas. As I said, in Scandinavian mythology, the dwarves are depicted as craftsmen, as representatives of a profession. We know very little about their families, and they do not, or whether they have any, and they do not fight. So the seeress's prophecy tells that during the final battle, they will stand passively before their stone doors and moan helplessly. Most of the humans will also be of little help, because the human race, according to the myth, will die out before the end of the world during a monstrous winter, which will last for 3 years, apart from one man and one woman from whom the later generations of humans will be born. The gods, however, will be assisted by human heroes chosen by Odin to fight on their side. And this is what the myth about Valhalla tells us. You may be familiar with it. Valhalla literally means the hall of the dead or the hall of the slain. It is the home of warriors who died in battle. They are known as Einherjar, an interesting word which means something like the only champions or the only fighters. Valhalla is a very pleasant place for the warriors to be, particularly in the evening, because this is when they feast and they have an endless supply of meat and also a boar who they cook and eat every night and who is reborn the next morning. But during the day, they fight with one another to practice their military skills. in preparation for the final battle when they will fight on the side of the gods. So this is their main occupation. This is what they are for. This idea of an alliance of different races in the struggle which unfolds throughout the history of the world was very important for Tolkien. In his Middle Earth, various races form such alliances in their fight against the forces of evil. This idea is embodied in the Fellowship of the Ring, which has the representatives of different races, the dwarves, the men, and so on, the wizards. And also in the Hobbits, for example, in the Battle of the Five Armies towards the end, when men, elves, and dwarves fight against the army of orcs. There is, however, another aspect of the struggle at the center of Scandinavian mythology which interested Tolkien and which he eloquently discussed in his lecture, Beowulf, the Monsters and the Critics. And this is the tragic fate of the protagonist of the struggle which unfolds throughout the history of the world and their response to their situation. As Tolkien emphasized in The Monsters and the Critics, unlike the gods of Greek mythology, the Scandinavian gods are not immortal and are aware of their fate, which is defeat and death in the final battle. There are several stories, including the Seeress's prophecy, which depict Odin, the main god, questioning one of the giants about the events at the end of the world. As I said, giants were believed to be more ancient than the gods, and so they had the reputation for wisdom. So there are several poems and stories where Odin questions one of the giants. But the answers which Odin gets are always the same, predicting his inevitable death at Ragnarok. This knowledge, however, does not change anything for the gods and their allies. This greatly impressed Tolkien, and he described it as northern courage. He discusses this idea of this kind of courage in The Monsters of the Critics. In The Monsters and the Critics. Again, in The Monsters and the Critics, he has a wonderful quotation from literary scholar William Kerr, which you may remember. The northern gods have an exultant extravagance in their warfare, which makes them more like Titans than Olympians. Only they are on the right side, though this is not the side that wins. The winning side is chaos and unreason, but the gods who are defeated think that defeat no refutation. Tolkien saw the northern courage as perseverance, not only without the promise of immortality given to Christian heroes, but with a full knowledge of eventual defeat and death. Courage and perseverance in desperate circumstances is characteristic of many of his heroes, including, for example, Frodo and Sam, who have little hope of surviving and destroying the ring in Mordor, or Aragorn and his companions in the Army of the West when they march to the Black Gate in hope to divert Sauron's attention from Frodo. So Tolkien returns to this idea, depicting this kind of courage again and again. And on the contrary, there are characters who do not possess such courage, and Tolkien shows the tragic consequences of this. You may remember Denethor, the steward of Gondor in The Lord of the Rings. He uses Palantir to learn about the future and becomes absolutely certain. He knows without any doubt that Gondor will be defeated by the forces of Mordor. He dies and brings close to destruction all those around him. What Denethor does not know, however, is that this is not what the future really holds, but an illusion brought about by Sauron's manipulation through Palantir. So we have seen today a few examples of Tolkien's engagement with medieval literature, and he was one of its most perceptive readers. One can say that medieval literature forms a background of his works, but it is also possible to say the opposite, that in his novels, Tolkien comments on medieval literature, supplying the missing information, refusing to see passages such as the catalogue of the dwarfs in Cirrus's prophecy as a meaningless and no longer comprehensible rigmarole, as so many have done before. It is certainly possible to enjoy Tolkien's novels knowing nothing about his inspiration. But if you are interested to learn more about the world in which his imagination roams, you need to read medieval literature in English, Old Norse, and ideally Finnish as well. So this is everything for today, but there will be another lecture next week, which will be about Tolkien's interest in languages and also about his invented languages. So I'm hoping to see you next week at the same time.